Thanks, all. I'm delighted to be here and to see so many friends. There's a lot of people I would like to point out in particular in the audience, judges and former students and colleagues and mentors, but there are just many too many of you to do that, so I will avoid identifying anyone. As Saul said, the topic I will discuss this afternoon is the Commander-in-Chief, and of course, in the world I inhabit, that is Saul. And so I thought a talk about the role of the dean would be fitting. Actually, of course, I'm not going to talk about the role of the dean. That would, I suppose, disappoint you, although Saul and I have a great interest in that subject. Instead, I am referring to the Commander-in-Chief of the United States, Dick Cheney. The role of Commander-in-Chief has become rather important and controversial over the last several years because of claims by the executive branch about the power in the president. There are a range of issues on which that question is currently fairly important, but the specific one I will focus on turns on the president's authorization of the National Security Agency to engage in surveillance. But before I turn specifically to that issue, let me say just a few words of background about the Commander-in-Chief provision. The Constitution provides in Article 2 that the President will be the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. And in recent years, we have heard, in my view all too often, assertions that essentially imply that that provision makes the Commander-in-Chief, that is the President, the supreme ruler of the United States in wartime. This is clearly not, in fact, an accurate understanding of the Constitution. For one thing, many provisions, nine in fact, in Article 1 of the Constitution, which defines the powers of Congress, delegate expressly to Congress a broad range of powers related to the military of the United States, including the power to raise and support armies, the power to regulate the Army and Navy, the power to determine when captures at seas and on land are permissible, the power to call out the militia, and so on. So the presidential powers with respect to the military are limited to those few words that the president shall be the Commander-in-Chief, whereas substantive authority over most issues relating more generally to the military is clearly assigned to Congress. Moreover, this is perfectly understandable from the standpoint of the framers of the Constitution, who certainly were wary of an overly centralized, overly powerful executive. The lessons they had learned from bitter experience, captured in the ideas of separation of powers and checks and balances, was that a king, an executive, with too much authority over the military posed a serious danger to a nation. And therefore, it was imperative in structuring the Constitution to limit rather sharply the degree of authority that the executive would have with respect to the military of the United States. On the other hand, there was clearly a need for an individual official to be on top of the decision-making with respect to military tactics, strategies, decisions, and therefore it made sense to place that responsibility in the president. But the way the framers tended to see the Commander-in-Chief power was sort of the capo de capo, that the president was the head general, the 10-star general, if you will. But his authority was essentially defined more or less by that of what one would imagine to be in the hands of the most important general within the military structure of the United States. Now, in trying to understand the limitations on the commander-in-chief power, there are at least three fairly obvious sources of limitation. The first is simply the inherent meaning of the clause itself. How far does it emanate? Second, there are specific constitutional provisions that limit the government, as well as the president. And third, there is acts of Congress which may limit or purport to limit the activities of the military. So the first of these is familiar in concept. All powers have inherent limitations on how far they run, whether it be necessary or proper, or whatever phrase one uses, reasonably related to something. Powers cannot be infinitely expanded as far as the imagination can take it. So if a president were to say, I am commander-in-chief, and therefore I can command everyone in the nation to wear blue, we would say that's ridiculous. Commander-in-chief power doesn't give you the power to do that. Not that it's a violation of anyone's constitutional right not to wear blue, not that Congress has said you can't do that, but that's just not how far the commander-in-chief power reaches. It has to be connected in some reasonable way to the core of the responsibility that was assigned to the president in Article 2. Now, surely that does, at the other extreme, cover things like making decisions about who should be promoted to the rank of general, or whether to invade a country using the Marines or the Army, or whether to invade from the north or the south. Those would be the types of, clearly the types of decisions one would expect the head general, the commander-in-chief, to have within his authority to make within the inherent scope of the commander-in-chief power. Much more difficult questions about the scope of the power, putting aside any external limitation, would be judgments about, for example, we need a larger military. So the president decrees a draft. This would logically be possible in the abstract, but clearly is unconstitutional because the Constitution gives to the Congress the power to raise and support armies. Or we need more money effectively to create and support the military that we want. Again, one could imagine a commander-in-chief therefore being able to unilaterally impose attacks. Again, that's clearly unconstitutional beyond the scope of the commander-in-chief power. It's the power of Congress to tax and to support the Army and Navy. And so there will be gray areas between the obvious theater of battle decision-making and, on the other extreme, everyone has to wear blue, or even I am going to institute a tax, or I am going to institute a draft, which would clearly be beyond the commander-in-chief power. So there is a gray area in which one has to figure out how far does this expand. And the second limitation is specific constitutional limitations on the government, such as the First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Eighth Amendment, and so on. So if the president, for example, were to say as commander-in-chief, no one in the military may criticize the president. That would clearly be within the commander-in-chief power, perhaps, but a violation of the First Amendment. Or if he said, no Jews may serve in the military, or no Jews may serve above the rank of captain in the military, that would clearly violate the religion clauses of the First Amendment. So the subject of who can be promoted and who can have what ranks in the military would be within the commander-in-chief power, but it would violate the First Amendment for the president to try to exercise that power in defiance of the Constitution. Similarly, if the president said that anyone in the military can be strip searched at will, that might well run up against the Fourth Amendment and could be held unconstitutional, despite the fact that maintaining a certain degree of order and so on in the military would generally be within the commander-in-chief power. That doesn't allow the president to run roughshod over the Fourth Amendment. And indeed, recently, the Supreme Court of the United States, in the Hamdi case, held specifically that the president was limited by the Due Process Clause in exercising his authority as Commander-in-Chief. When President Bush took the position that American citizens captured in Afghanistan could be held as enemy combatants indefinitely without any hearing and without any access to an attorney to litigate the question whether or not they were in fact enemy combatants, the Supreme Court held no, that although the president does, within the scope of the commander-in-chief power, have authority to detain individuals captured on the battlefield, that does not mean he has the power to ignore the Due Process Clause in deciding whether or not a particular individual actually was an enemy combatant or was actually an innocent person who was simply captured on the field of battle, although not engaged in any military activity against the United States. And the third limitation on the commander-in-chief power relates to acts of Congress. In many respects, Congress has concurrent jurisdiction over matters that touch upon the commander-in-chief power. And the question is, what happens when Congress says the president may not do something in the form of legislation that is at least arguably within the commander-in-chief power if Congress had not said he could not do it? And the Supreme Court has long made clear that the president is subject to acts of Congress in this respect, just as all the rest of us are subject to acts of Congress when those acts are constitutional. So as early as 1804, the Supreme Court held in the Barem case that when John Adams, during the naval war between the United States and France in 1798, authorized the capture of ships coming from France, that was an unconstitutional act authorized by the president because Congress had authorized the capture of ships going to France, but had explicitly decided not to authorize the capture of ships coming from France. And the court said that was a decision that, in the absence of some legislative action, might have been within the scope of the president's authority as commander-in-chief, but given that Congress had made that decision, the president had to respect it. Similarly, 150 years later, during the Korean War, when Harry Truman sought to seize the steel industry at the time of a nationwide steel strike that he felt would cripple the ability of the nation to continue to manufacture steel necessary for the military effort of the United States, the Supreme Court held that the president could not do this, not necessarily because it would be outside the scope of the commander-in-chief power in the absence of an act of Congress, didn't decide that question, but it said since Congress had explicitly decided not to authorize the president to have that authority, that that bound the president, and that therefore his authority as commander-in-chief could not override the legislative judgment of Congress. So all of that is background to the question posed by President Bush's authorization to the National Security Agency to engage in surveillance of international phone calls and emails that apparently involve a participant with some connection to a terrorist organization. First question, given the outline I've just given, would be whether this would be within the bounds of the president's authority of commander-in-chief in the absence of any constitutional limitation or congressional limitation. And that would be a close question because it involves domestic as well as international foreign surveillance, but probably I would say it does fall within the commander-in-chief power. Presidents have always had the authority to engage in spying and information gathering, intelligence gathering in wartime, both individuals who were outside the United States and individuals communicating with persons inside the United States, and no one has ever generally thought that to be on its face unconstitutional, and therefore I would say that standing alone, the president can authorize information gathering techniques in order to protect the national security in his role as commander-in-chief. The second obvious question is whether this particular program violates the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which of course prohibits unreasonable search and seizures and requires ordinarily a judicial warrant based upon probable cause before the government may engage in a wiretap. The program of NSA surveillance authorized by the president requires neither a judicial warrant nor probable cause. So it clearly would seem to be in direct contradiction to the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. And therefore, like my example earlier of saying no one may criticize the president being a clear violation of the First Amendment, one might say this is a clear violation by analogy of the Fourth Amendment. In fact, it's not quite so clear under the law for the following reason. In 1972, President Nixon took the position that the president had the inherent authority as commander-in-chief to conduct warrantless wiretaps in order to protect the national security. The Supreme Court, in a case called United States versus United States District Court, the Keith case, unanimously held that Nixon was wrong and that the executive must comply with the Fourth Amendment, including the probable cause and warrant requirements, even when the purpose of a wiretap is for the national security. However, the court set aside the question, not directly presented in Keith, as to whether there should be a foreign intelligence exception to the Fourth Amendment. So it put aside the question when the president is seeking not simply to protect the national security by engaging in an entirely domestic surveillance, but is attempting to engage in information gathering relating to foreign agents who may be in the United States, whether that poses a different question under the Fourth Amendment. In fact, all the reasoning of the court in Keith, all of the policy logic relied upon by the court in rejecting the national security exemption to the Fourth Amendment, would seem pretty strongly to apply as well to foreign intelligence wiretaps. But because the court put the question aside and hasn't had an opportunity to address it in the 30-some years since, one cannot say that as a matter of established law that this program necessarily violates the Fourth Amendment, although I should say that my view is that a fair reading of Keith and the logic underlying Keith suggests that there should be no greater exception for foreign intelligence within the United States surveillance than national security intelligence within the United States. But that's an open question. So that may not necessarily foreclose the Bush administration activity. But that brings us to the most important issue about the legality of this action, and that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. As many of you will recall, in the early 1970s, the Congress and the Church Committee investigations and so on discovered that over the past decade, various agencies of the federal government, including the FBI, the CIA, Army Intelligence, and the National Security Agency, had been engaged in a broad range of unlawful surveillance activities of American citizens. And that by the early 1970s, files had been created on more than 500,000 American citizens, largely as a result of unlawful surveillance, because of their political activities primarily relating to the Vietnam War. When all of that came to light in the early 1970s, Congress and most Americans were appalled. It was that disclosure that began to have an impact in the decision, for example, in the Keith case. It also led Attorney General Edward Leavy, well known to this audience, to promulgate the Leavy guidelines, which prohibited FBI agents from engaging in surveillance of any organizations or individuals engaged in protected First Amendment activities. And it also led to Congress enacting FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, what Congress did was to address the question that the Supreme Court had left open in Keith, That is, it asks itself, should we authorize or prohibit or do nothing with respect to foreign intelligence surveillance intercepts by the president? Should they be held to the same standards as national security wiretaps, the court held the Fourth Amendment requires under Keith, or should we at least statutorily recognize an exemption from at least statutory law, if not the Fourth Amendment, for these sorts of wiretaps? And there were hearings, and ultimately Congress enacted and the president signed the legislation. And what the legislation did was essentially to recognize that foreign intelligence involves special problems of secrecy and sometimes special problems of expedition. So it created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a special court that had particularized procedures designed to ensure both expedition of the processing of the government's requests and also a high degree of secrecy, higher than even would be true in ordinary federal courts. But the legislation unequivocally insisted that even foreign intelligence surveillance must be justified by a judicially issued warrant by the special FISA court based upon a finding of probable cause. So the Congress made a judgment that there should be no exemption from the ordinary requirements of probable cause and warrant in the context of foreign intelligence surveillance. That statute, on its face, unequivocally makes illegal, and it is itself a criminal statute, makes illegal the president's authorization to the National Security Agency to engage in electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes without going to FISA and without getting a warrant. So the question then is there any way this could not be illegal, given the fact that the statute on its face would appear to prohibit precisely what the president authorized? And the administration has made two arguments in defense of its action, claiming that it did not need to comply with the requirements of FISA, both of which, in my view, are spurious and highly problematic. The one more obviously so than the other, but both, in my view, not worthy of serious attention. The first argument is that after 9/11, 3 days after 9/11, Congress enacted the authorization to use military force. That is, in response to the attack on the United States, it authorized the president to use reasonable force to respond to those who would attack the nation. And the Bush administration has argued that the authorization to use military force essentially trumped FISA. That what it did is give the president the authority to do certain things that the president could not have done prior to the enactment of the authorization to use military force. And included among those things was to engage in foreign intelligence surveillance without a warrant, without probable cause, even of American citizens on American soil, which otherwise would clearly have been prohibited by FISA. Now, the authorization to use military force says absolutely nothing about surveillance, electronic or otherwise. It says absolutely nothing about foreign intelligence surveillance. It says absolutely nothing about wiretapping. It simply says basically what I just stated, that the president may use reasonable force in order to respond to those who attack the nation. But obviously implicit within that is an authorization to do a range of things that have to do with powers connected to war and presumably to the commander-in-chief power. So the question is, did the authorization to use military force overrule FISA by implication? Now, that argument would be a plausible argument that we as lawyers could sit around and chew over, but for a very specific provision in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act anticipated the possibility of even a declaration of war in the future. And it expressly provided that in the event of a future declaration of war, the president may, for a period of 15 days after such declaration, avoid the requirements of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, if he wishes to do so, and within that 15-day period may come to Congress and seek an amendment of FISA. Now, clearly, the authorization to use military force, whatever else it is not more than a declaration of war. And therefore, the AUMF could not possibly be seen as having trumped FISA, which itself precisely anticipated the situation and essentially made clear the president would have 15 days in which to act outside the requirements of FISA, but only 15 days. And right now we're working on 4 years in which the president has refused to seek an amendment to the FISA statute and acted in clear defiance of it. So the first argument, I think, is one that utterly holds no water, and I don't think any sensible lawyer could actually, with a straight face, make the argument that given that particular provision of FISA and given the ambiguity of the AUMF, that the AUMF was not more than a declaration of war and therefore wouldn't have done any more to trump FISA than a declaration of war would have done. The second argument made by the administration is somewhat more credible. It essentially argues that FISA is unconstitutional. And at the core of this argument is the claim that the president has a certain inherent authority as commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy that only the president may exercise, and that for Congress to attempt to intrude upon that power would be unconstitutional, and that the power to engage in electronic surveillance that includes surveillance of American citizens on American soil is an inherent part of the commander-in-chief power that Congress may not touch. Now, the basic principle of the argument, I think, is right. That is, there probably is a core of the commander-in-chief power that belongs unilaterally to the president, so that if the Congress attempted to legislate to tell the president what he may or may not do within that core, that such statutes would be unconstitutional. So again, if Congress, for example, attempted to dictate who should be promoted within the ranks of the military, or attempted to dictate battlefield decisions to the president, then those statutes might well be seen to go beyond the appropriate role of legislation and to intrude unconstitutionally on the turf that belongs exclusively to the president. It would be as if Congress passed a law telling the president he can't veto legislation. Clearly, that would be unconstitutional. But it seems to me that the power to authorize electronic surveillance of American citizens on American soil goes far beyond the core of the commander-in-chief power that rests exclusively and unilaterally in the hands of the president, just as the power to initiate a draft or initiate a tax goes far beyond that power. Here it seems to me that the president might have the authority to do this in the absence of legislation, but that Congress, as in the steel seizure context, as in the Barem context with the ships sailing to and from France, Congress has concurrent jurisdiction over questions of electronic surveillance of American citizens, and therefore certainly has the ability, just as it did in the steel seizure case and just as it did in the Barem case, to say that whether or not the president could do this without legislation, the president cannot do this in the face of legislation. So that basically explains as best I can what the issues are in this issue about national security surveillance. My own view is that this program is unlawful, if not unconstitutional, and that we face a very serious challenge to our system of government at the moment. because we have a Congress that, for political reasons, understandable political reasons, has no interest in engaging in ordinary oversight of the executive with respect to its exercise of its authority. We have a situation where it is very difficult for courts, for various jurisdictional and standing reasons, to get a handle on the constitutionality of this program, and where the president has essentially said, screw you. Under ordinary circumstances, one would expect the Congress to hold hearings on these questions, to seriously engage whether or not the president's actions are lawful, and whether they want to ratify them. One thing Congress could do, of course, is to say, well, we think they're unlawful, but we actually think they're also a good idea, so we're going to amend FISA, we're going to ignore the illegality, we're going to amend FISA, and we're going to say it's okay going forward. This is actually what happened when Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus at the beginning of the Civil War. The power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus under the Constitution is in Article 1 and belongs to Congress. Lincoln faced a situation right after Fort Sumter where Union troops were trying to make their way down through Maryland to reach the nation's capital to protect it from possible invasion by Confederate forces from the south, and they were blocked in their effort to get through Maryland by secessionist sympathizers, and the nation's capital was at grievous risk of being captured by the Confederacy. Faced with that situation, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus in parts of Maryland and therefore authorized the U.S. military, the Union forces, to arrest and to imprison in military facilities individuals who were blocking the U.S. troops from making their way to the Capitol. Lincoln himself implicitly recognized that this was not within his constitutional authority, but it was necessary in the circumstances, and then went to Congress and sought ratification from Congress of the decision, which he, in fact, obtained, but could not have gone to Congress initially because Congress was not in session, and in 1861, it was not possible to convene Congress on the spur of the moment. Whatever legitimacy there was in Lincoln's actions simply don't apply in the current situation, because there was no emergency that required the president to put this program in place, certainly none that would have required more than 15 days, which he was allowed to use, or arguably could have reasonably used under the Foreign Security Intelligence Act, and instead gone to Congress and sought ratification for the creation of the program. So what we have, in my view, is a situation of a president who has acted blatantly unlawfully, where no one seems able or willing to hold him accountable. And this is not an unusual challenge in the history of the United States. This has happened oftentimes in our history in times of crisis. But one of the ways we as a nation measure ourselves is how we are able to respond to these situations, whether we are able to find a way to make clear the illegality of government action, and in one way or another, to take the problem seriously and hold those who've acted unlawfully accountable. Thank you. Thank you. I'll be happy to take questions or, as Saul said, call on you. Yes, there is. It's an interesting question. The question is, would the president have the authority to withdraw troops from Iraq unilaterally without going to Congress and seeking approval for withdrawal? I guess I would say that the president could order withdrawal, but that if Congress enacted legislation prohibiting it, that would be constitutional, and he would have to abide by it. So in the absence of congressional legislation, I think he could act and withdraw troops. But if Congress said, we don't want you to withdraw troops, I think they probably could order that the troops remain there. I'm making this up, by the way. I mean, it's not like it's case law. John. Okay, so the question is, if it's conceded that the commander-in-chief has particular responsibility in a battlefield situation and should be given particular deference in the theater of war, then what about the fact that in the war on terror, everything is the theater of war, and therefore the scope of the president's authority has to be broadened to deal with danger wherever it presents itself? That argument has been made on a number of prior occasions. After all, subversion, espionage, sabotage are commonplace in war, whether it's the war on terrorism or World War I or World War II. The scale may be different, but the fact that there are spies and saboteurs is certainly always true in wartime, and assassins. And I think that there is a clear understanding that theater of war here, although it may have some ambiguity, has to be defined in a more focused way than simply saying anywhere where there's a possible threat to the United States. And the court actually addressed this question to some degree in the Seal Seizure case, where it made clear that the theater of war did not mean strikes in steel manufacturers in the United States, even though those could have a dramatic effect on the war. So if you have an invading army, as Lincoln did, for example, clearly the theater of war would include any place where there was a real theater of operations where there were battlefield conditions. But even in the Civil War, it was recognized that that didn't extend to areas that were not directly within the battlefield. So I would say in a war on terrorism, this has to be somewhat more flexibility to defining the geographical boundaries of where the war is than in more conventional wars. But I don't think it's persuasive to say that it's everywhere. One of the things Jackson said in the Steel Seizure case, which I think was really a critical point, was that the president is commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, not of the United States. And one wants to be very careful not to let the former slip over to the latter just because one could come up with a reason why it might be thinkable that the battlefield is broader.
Well, I was curious because when I was an enlisted man some years ago, I was told by my superiors that my rights under the Bill of Rights were severely limited. And among other things, I was not permitted to speak badly about any of my superiors, except I could speak badly about a non-com out of his presence. Would you say that was an unconstitutional regulation?
The question is, there was a time in the military when it was made clear that you could not criticize your superior officer, although you could criticize those who were beneath you in the ranks. Was the prior, the upward directed rule permissible? Clearly, under existing law, that would be deemed unconstitutional. Courts have held that even in the military, there is a measure of freedom of speech. It's not a freedom to be insubordinate, to refuse to obey orders, but it is a freedom to criticize. And so, again, there are circumstances when the criticism would be regarded as impermissible, like on a battlefield. But if you're talking about criticizing a superior officer in a camp, I think that would be regarded as perfectly appropriate and protected by the First Amendment, although that would not necessarily have been the law at the time that you were talking about. Not that I mean this to be partisan, but the only way to make those relevant is to vote Democratic. I mean, the practical reality. If you want to see either of those avenues taken, it's not going to happen with a Republican Congress. And again, I don't mean that as a criticism of the Republicans on being partisan. Democrats would be just as partisan if everything was flipped. But it is the fact that you're not likely to see a Republican Senate or a Republican House take steps to impeach a Republican president or to even cut off funds for a Republican president, certainly not in these times and in the present world. Right. So the questions about the unitary executive argument, and I have to be careful there, because the truth is I don't really think I understand all the implications of this. But as I understand it, there are two elements that get captured by the idea of the unitary executive, which has created such angst. One of them has to do with the notion that the president has the authority to determine all policy for the executive branch, and that even independent agencies that are created by Congress have to be answerable to the president and have to follow the policies determined by the president because they are part of the executive branch, even though they're determined and intended to be independent agencies. And that raises the question of whether there can be such a thing as an independent agency within the executive branch, or whether they all automatically have to be responsive to the president. The signing statement issue is slightly different. The signing statement issue, which has come to the fore recently, as I understand it, is that the ordinary practice of presidents, historically, if they do not like a bill that's been passed by Congress, is to veto it. And then they send it back and they say, if you want to get it passed, either change it to satisfy what I want or override my veto. The signing statement device is not new with this Bush administration, but it's become increasingly prevalent over the last 20, 25 years, and dramatically so over the last 5 or 6 years. Is essentially to say, I will sign this law adopted by Congress, but I will sign it on my understanding that it means only certain things, and that it is unconstitutional, in my view, if it were to mean something else. And therefore, I will not enforce it insofar as I think it is unconstitutional or otherwise represents policy I choose not to support. And that poses the problem of what is the responsibility of the president to execute the laws as they are enacted, and what power does the president have to decide not to execute laws that he signed into law that he now chooses to interpret differently from the way courts would or the way the Congress would, by simply stipulating that torture to me doesn't mean what torture meant to the Congress. And so I will sign the law, but I'm not going to stop doing what the Act says I should not be doing, because I think if it goes as far as the Act does, it's unconstitutional. And so, again, historically, the right thing to do is not to sign the law and veto it. And what President Bush has been doing increasingly is signing the laws, avoiding the conflict with the Congress, and then just going ahead and doing whatever he pleases and not executing or complying with the law itself. And that does pose a serious problem with respect to the relationship between Congress and the president. And how does that issue ever get litigated? It's not clear who would ever have standing to challenge the non-enforcement of the law by the president. So it poses a very difficult problem. And it's an example of aggrandizing the power of the president, giving the president the power. And this is, the Bush administration has been saying all these years, never vetoed a bill. That was really impressive. It didn't occur to me why they didn't veto a bill. They didn't veto a bill because they didn't think the bills mattered. And that is a little bit unnerving. And I don't think anybody understands the full implications of this and the extent to which it's been going on, the implications of the extent to which it's been going on. But I think I read in the Boston Globe that 750 bills the president has signed into law with signing statements, which basically say, in all or a part, I will not enforce this.
Short question is, Is it technologically, is the fact pattern a little bit more complicated than you've suggested? I think a month or two ago, you were on a program, Chicago Tonight, WTTW, with John Schmidt, who's no shrinking violet, I think, in generally protecting civil liberties under three in the Clinton Justice Department. And you would know better than I, so correct me if you can state it better than I can, but it seemed as if he was arguing that the application process, one, for FISA is extremely complex, filling out mortgages, he analogized, or multiple mortgages. And two, the system that was being used to discover these numbers, to identify the numbers for which there would be wireless intercepts, was very complicated. Talked to doing it with computers and so forth. And the process of finding a laptop on the battlefield, so to speak, with all of these numbers, digesting them, filling out the FISA applications, and doing it on a timely basis, even with the 15-day requirement, and doing it with not tipping off your hand as you try to, as apparently they did, notify Congress generally of this, but not seek their approval. So given that fact pattern, you know, I know people, I'm sure, for several hundred years, have argued the situation is different, we have to cut corners on the Constitution, but not putting it as baldly as that, is there a more sympathetic argument to make? Because it sounded as if Schmidt was arguing, one, factually, this should be allowed, but two, yes, it was constitutional, and I assume he was arguing, again, the inherent power of the Commander-in-Chief.
Okay, so the arguments, the question is, are there better arguments for the legality of the NSA surveillance program than any of the ones I presented? And I didn't try to make all the arguments that one could make, but there are other arguments. I don't know if they're better arguments, but there are other arguments, and I'll mention a couple that you just identified. One is the fact that the FISA warrant process is cumbersome. That is, you have to put together a complicated set of materials in order to demonstrate to the court that there is probable cause to engage in the electronic surveillance. And that may just be more of a burden than is appropriate for foreign electronic surveillance. Well, first thing to note is that under the 1978 statute, as enacted, Congress provided that the Attorney General may authorize the initiation of foreign intelligence gathering without first getting a warrant from FISA for a period of 24 hours anytime he certifies that there is a need for immediacy in the surveillance and therefore can do that before getting a warrant. An extraordinary provision that doesn't exist really anywhere else in American law. So that was designed to take care of the problem of immediate need to start the wiretap or the surveillance instantly. In the Patriot Act, the Bush administration amended that section of FISA to extend it to 4 days, saying that 1 day was not long enough and 4 days would be necessary to be able to really meet the requirements of the FISA legislation, and Congress approved that. So the question of is it too cumbersome to work was actually addressed by the administration, and they sought legislation to give the Attorney General the authority to initiate surveillance for a period of 4 days without getting a warrant, and that's what they seemed to think was necessary to satisfy their needs under the Act. If for some reason they concluded that 4 days wasn't enough, the proper response, of course, was to go back to Congress and seek to amend the Act and let Congress decide whether they would extend it to 7 days or 10 days or whatever, rather than to simply ignore the problem entirely and just go ahead and do whatever they felt like. So that argument seems to me to be a perfectly legitimate policy argument with a perfectly simple solution, which is to go back to Congress and try to persuade Congress that you need more time to do this. And it's exactly what they did initially after 9/11. The second argument is that this is a very complex form of searching. That what's happening here is not the sort of usual image of gathering probable cause that we think about when we think about police officers getting probable cause about whether some evidence exists at a particular place. Rather, what's happening is you've got very sophisticated computers that are screening millions, perhaps billions of telephone calls, looking for keywords, running them through algorithms, and trying to decide when certain the appearance of certain words or numbers or whatever gives rise to some confidence that one of the people in a phone call is someone connected to a terrorist organization. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate way to establish probable cause. I don't have any problem with using that as a means to establish probable cause, but you still need to have probable cause, and you still should have to have a court determine that the algorithm you're using establishes probable cause. And there's no reason why the FISA court couldn't have done that. So if there are technological mechanisms by which the administration is screening phone calls for the purpose of deciding which ones to, quote, listen in on, then the proper thing to do would be to go to the FISA court and say, this is how we're proceeding. We want you to tell us whether or not this way of going about it and this algorithm, which produces these results and these confidence levels, is sufficient to meet the probable cause standard. It's a little bit like dog bark, dog sniffing cases, right? When the dog sniffs the suitcase and you conclude that when the dog barks, there's probable cause. Well, to get that conclusion, you have to do enough tests to decide that the dog's right often enough to justify the notion that when the dog barks, there's probable cause. That's really the same thing, except much more simple, than the algorithm that's being used here. There's no reason why that couldn't go to FISA, to the FISA court. The third argument is that what's going on is very secret, and we don't want the terrorists to know what we are doing, because if they know what we're doing, obviously it'll make it less effective, and if we go to Congress and hold hearings on an amendment to FISA, then of course everyone in the world will know what we're doing, and that'll undermine the entire proposition. Now, this is a really interesting and hard problem about when the government can do things that otherwise would be illegal, because to get them adopted in some lawful means would make them ineffective. But in this instance, it seems to me, from everything at least I've been able to discern, a largely unpersuasive argument. You don't need to go to Congress with the details of the technology you're using. You need to go to Congress and say, can we use algorithms to determine whether there is probable cause? Or can we go to Congress and say, we don't want to have probable cause in a warrant? We want to be able to get the authority without probable cause in a warrant to intercept international phone calls and emails. And certainly, Al-Qaeda is not imagining that their phone calls and emails aren't being intercepted. So it's not as if this is some great secret that they are relying on. So I think the idea that this blows the whistle on the process is both wrong with respect to the basic reality and overblown with respect to what you would have to reveal to get legal approval. I mean, if nothing else, all you need is legal approval, if Congress wanted to give it, that you could intercept international emails and phone calls without probable cause and warrant. And Congress could decide that question. That doesn't tell Al-Qaeda anything other than that you're doing that. And by the way, the whole Patriot Act was subject to the exact same argument, just to be clear. The Patriot Act allows a whole lot of law enforcement devices that were not previously allowed. And once, of course, you tell the enemy that you're now allowed to use them, like sneak and peek searches and going to libraries and getting all the list of books that people have taken out, then of course they know you're doing that, so it changes their behavior. So if the administration was serious about this, they wouldn't have bothered with the Patriot Act either. They would just have said, we can't go to Congress, we're just going to do these things, because the president has the inherent authority to do them, and if we told the Congress we were doing them, then it would make them ineffective. It's the exact same argument. And since they didn't make it in the Patriot Act, I see no reason why it's any more credible with respect to the national security program. Do you want me to be done? One more? Okay. Yes. Right. There are several types of cases that are in early stages, all of which have real problems in terms of getting to the next stage. The most direct form are lawsuits that have been brought claiming that individuals and organizations, usually journalists, ACLU, have been unlawfully wiretapped by the NSA in this program. The problem is, of course, nobody knows whether he or she has been unlawfully wiretapped, because who has been the subject of this has been held secret. So the plaintiffs are alleging that it seems reasonable to me, given that I'm a journalist who talks to people in Iraq all the time, and I suspect some of the people I talk to were thought by the administration to be terrorists, maybe some of them even are terrorists, and therefore I think I probably must have been wiretapped. But they can't actually allege they have been wiretapped. And as a matter of standing, the courts have held in the past that you cannot challenge the legality of a government program of this sort unless you can show that you have actually been a victim of the program. It's kind of a perfect example of Catch-22. But that is going to be a real obstacle to the civil suits that have been brought. A second type of case is there are some criminal prosecutions of individuals in the United States for allegedly engaging in terrorist activities or supporting terrorist organizations where the defense lawyers have now sought discovery of whether or not their clients were in fact subjected to NSA surveillance under this authorization on the premise that it's unlawful and therefore the evidence can't be used against them, and remains to be seen whether how those will work out. And the third avenue by which one might see this is that the administration obviously has talked quite aggressively about prosecuting both the sources from within the government, presumably the NSA, and prosecuting the reporters and the New York Times for publishing the information. And if those prosecutions go forward, at one point or another, either the reporters who were summoned to the grand jury to reveal their sources, or the sources in defense of the leak, or the reporters and the newspapers in defense of the publications, would probably, well, undoubtedly argue that it's unconstitutional to prohibit them from leaking or requiring them to reveal sources or publishing because the programs were illegal. So they'd be setting that up as a defense against a criminal prosecution. But that's all fairly far down the road, and it's not clear how any of those would play out in practice. Thank you all so much.